Men on Board, episode 24. Today, the category is Deck Building Plus. We're going to be taking a look at Quest for El Dorado and Clank. In our broader view, we're going to have a discussion about maintaining cards. Hello, and thank you for downloading Men on Board. My name is Aaron.
This is Josh.
Jameson.
And I'm Matt.
And we are all back together again.
Hey, sorry guys. I missed you all. Yeah.
There was a long gap last time when we said goodbye because I was waiting for you to say goodnight.
Was I in the outtakes?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. I'm going to get caught up on that one too.
And if you haven't heard our last episode, at the end of it, we put out a call for feedback. We are still looking for some feedback as we go into year two, trying to figure out what directions that we should go in, what we can work on. So if you have any constructive criticism, let us know. All right. So today we are talking not just about ourselves, but we're also talking about deck building games.
Two great deck building games.
And because this was another one of our in-series episodes, this is Deck Building Plus. So by now, you probably know the basic mechanics of deck building, where you start off with an identical deck as other players. And throughout the game, there are mechanics.
Basic deck.
Basic deck, yes. And usually those decks are somewhere around 8 attack cards and 4 purchase cards, or vice versa.
Maybe a movement card or two thrown in there for fun. It's pretty close.
But throughout the game, you have the ability to purchase new cards to shuffle into your deck through your discard pile.
Maybe you haven't played a deck builder. There's a lot of engine creation in how you create your deck. It sort of drives your whole gameplay. It's cool. It's a pretty solid mechanic.
So these games take deck building and add something a little bit extra.
A lot extra.
Yeah.
I'd like to say a purpose, but that's getting too deep into my thoughts about these games.
But we'll get into that in the explanations. What you won't hear in these explanations is the basic concepts of deck building. We're starting things off today with Clank, and I believe Matt is doing that breakdown.
So Clank is a game from 2016. It is for 2 to 4 players and takes about 30 to 60 minutes. It is designed by Paul Denon, with art by Rafe Beiser, Raul Ramos, and Nate Storm. It's published by Renegade Game Studios. It MSRPs for $60, but you can usually find it on sale on Amazon or other websites. So, Clank is a deck-building, pressure-luck adventuring game where players are burglars trying to sneak into a dungeon and steal treasure from a dragon, and then get back out before the dragon awakes and eats them. Like most deck building games, players start with the basic hand, try to get better stuff. In Clank, cards basically do one of three things. They give you skill points for buying new cards, swords for fighting off the monsters in the dungeons for rewards, and boots for moving around the dungeon from space to space. So, in Clank, there are 5 steps to being a master burglar. Step 1 is the target. Players need to maneuver into the depths of the dungeon to acquire an artifact that they must escape the dungeon with. And when whoever escapes the dungeon with the most points wins. Step 2 is your plan. Players need to use the cards that they draw each turn to move around, fight, acquire cards, buy items, and basically do whatever you need to achieve step 1. Step 3 is your mark, and this is the dragon. At the end of every turn, new cards are added to the market row, and if any of them have a dragon symbol on them, the dragon attacks. When the dragon attacks, one player puts all the cubes from the Clank area into a bag and then draws a certain number out. If your color cube is drawn, then you take damage and you're one step closer to death. Now, the Clank area is one of the unique features of this game. As you play certain cards, you are instructed to add cubes into the Clank area, because whatever you're doing is making noise and getting the attention of the dragon. So being a good burglar means being quiet. And as the game goes on, the dragon will become more powerful and deal more damage to the players. Step 4 is your getaway. Once you have an artifact, you are free to leave the dungeon and escape the castle. But remembering that escaping first is only helpful if you have the most points. Also, part of your getaway plan is keeping in mind what happens to you when you die. If you die without an artifact in your hand, then you're eliminated from the game. If you die with an artifact, but you're still in the bottom half of the dungeons, you die. But if you die with an artifact in the upper half of the dungeon, the villagers will come rescue you, bring you back to life with a phoenix down or something, and you get to score your points. Step 5 is the end of the line. Once a player has escaped the dungeon or been knocked out, they no longer take a turn in the game. And if they were the first person to escape or be knocked out, then a timer starts, and each time that player would take a turn, the dragon attacks instead. The fourth time that the dragon attacks this way, he instantly kills everyone left in the dungeon, but villagers will still rescue anyone that is in the upper half with an artifact. Players then tally up any points from artifacts, tokens, gold, cards, and whoever has the most points wins. And that's Clank.
Josh, Clank was one of your games, right?
It was. I think I was the first one to even hear of it for some reason, because it came... There wasn't a lot of fanfare when it got announced or when I found it, but yeah, I was instantly drawn to this game because I like deck builders. They're not my favorite game, but I like the dungeon crawl, and I love press your luck games. I love anything that has a lot of tension into it. And more to the point, I had read a review at some point that said that this game made deck builders have a purpose for the person. And I was like, oh, this is great, because I kind of find the deck builders get very dry and very mechanical a lot of the time. So this added an element of fun, whimsy, and like more play interaction, because you have to be super cognizant of where other people are on the board, because as soon as someone grabs that first artifact, they could just make a run to get out of the dungeon back again and leave you stuck down there without something to go to. So the way that you build your deck, the way the game's going to progress, and then reading the other players at the table and how they think they're going to go about progressing in their own little quest for an artifact down in the depths of the dungeon just lent a really unique feel to the deck building genre that I hadn't found in another game. And I was delighted by how it felt, and I've played it with a number of different people, gamers and non-gamers, and everyone has universally really enjoyed it a lot. I think it's something about just throwing your cubes. So when you make noise, you get little cubes, and they get added to the dragon bag. So whenever the dragon, quote-unquote, attacks, you draw cubes out of the bag, and however many of your cubes get drawn out of the bag, you take those wounds as damage. So that mechanism of just waiting around and seeing if your cube's the one that's going to come out of that bag, knowing that you've been, you know, crashing into things down in the depths of the dungeon and making all kinds of racket with your armor that you bought, even though it's really powerful, it just makes a ton of noise. So, and then there's a little stealthy vixen over there that's been sneaking down around things and has no cubes in that bag, and somehow all of those cubes come out, and you're like, that just doesn't seem right. But it's great. I think it's a really great game, and adds an element of fun, a little bit of control, and a little bit of chaos, and I think it has a good mix for me.
I really like the theme of this game. And so Josh mentioned something about board games having a purpose, or deck builders having a purpose specifically. This is also an extremely literal board game. It's a lot less abstract. It's not something where you're putting tiles in rows to try to score points. It's not something where you're stacking cards in sequence. This is one where you're navigating a map. And the map that it makes you navigate is something that's extremely iconic, but doesn't necessarily appear in this exact kind of modern board game. It's in all kinds of video games. There's rogues and roguelikes. It kind of, you know, it has callbacks to MUDs and Dwarf Fortress and that kind of thing. There's even a place on the map where if you cross at the extreme left, you come out right. But it
it's
also
like Pac-Man.
It is. And it also taps into the pen and paper role playing aspect of it. And at the very end, it combines these really strong thematic mechanics. And I, let it be clear, I feel this way about El Dorado too, but it makes you do something that feels like you're doing something. You're not just playing a board game, you're moving yourself through a map that's illustrated here. And every now and then, probably more often than not actually, I like having mechanics that literal.
I like how many choices I feel like I have in this game. I like that I'm not really railroaded into a certain path to go to. And even though there's only so many different paths on the board,
right,
I never feel constricted in the game.
And the decision to turn back is, I mean, Josh brought it up already. It's so critical, and it brings, even if you're on the same path you've been on 10 times before as a player or whatever, you're still making a decision based on the tempo of the game and the other players with you.
Yeah, I think the entire game, I have an exit path in mind. Mm-hmm. That I think once I step into the bottom half of the dungeon, I'm constantly making my exit route and readjusting my exit route each time, just so I'm always aware of, okay, I'm this many movement points away from the exit, I'm this many turns away from the exit, so if someone makes a line for it, I'm still good. Once I step in the bottom half, I'm constantly calculating that out in my head because I'm always paranoid that someone's going to run.
I think that's what I love about the game, Matt. I totally agree with you. I find it keeps me more invested than other games do because I am hyper aware of what everyone else is doing. Once you cross that threshold of, oh, it could end at any moment now, and he could take that artifact. Like, in my mind, I want that scarab thing. Like, that's what I'm going for. And you can see if someone else is making a move there, and you can almost calculate, oh, they're probably going to get there before I am. Okay, I got to switch directions. I'm going to go for this little shield down here, and I'll get that. And I guess I can make the points up if I, like, make a quick run at the market, but to do that, I have to do this other thing. But they're not going to want to escape because they don't have the points to do it. So it's great. That moment when everyone gets down in the depths is really, I think it's really tense and really keeps my interest level the entire time for the rest of the game. And it doesn't go downhill from there for me.
There's something that a lot of board games do. And I'm going to use Splendor as an example because it's a game I really like and other people here are a little bit cooler on. But there's almost always a point where you realize that you're in the final chapter and you almost break your immersion or your participation in the regular flow of the story to see if you can sprint to the lead as far as the actual scoring mechanic goes. A lot of the time, if it is something that's really thematic, that can be sort of, you're just sort of changing your whole perspective on the game. You're seeing if you can make that final lap in the speed you need to or whatever. Here, that's what the rogue is doing the entire time. Like, you playing the role of the piece in this game are supposed to be constantly figuring out how what your contingency plan can be, how you can possibly squeak out alive, what's the furthest you can go. You're in the mindset that the game wants you to be in the entire time, not just until you're trying to decide whether you win or not.
Once someone gets that first artifact, you're more or less kind of already in the end game, even if that happens like 5 minutes into the game, because once one person has one artifact, they just have to leave the dungeon, and then you got three turns left. So it creates this weird feeling where, you know, the quote end game can begin really early in the game, and you have end game tension for a really long time.
I'm terrible at this game. I went back and looked over my stats of the times I've played this game. I have never lived to the end of this game. I have never once gone out alive. I've only gone a score other than zero twice.
Out of how many times, approximately?
About a half a dozen.
Okay.
That blows my mind. I didn't even realize that at some point.
I just pushed my luck way too far.
Yeah.
And even when I do get back up, there is just way too much clank in that bag for me to have any chance of getting out.
But do you enjoy it? Like, do you enjoy it? That's what, so if I lose or die too, I don't think it's a personal attack because that dragon bag is just, you did it. Like, you knew the clank things.
When I eventually get out, I'm going to crush everyone else's score. Like,
well, and spectacular last-minute failure is also a key theme in the games that this is inspired by.
I died on the last space. That's absolutely happened to me before. Like, one boot away, just didn't make it.
So this might just be me. I don't know if this has been similar to anyone else's experience. I like that the deck is huge. Like, the cards that come out, it's just randomly shuffled from this big deck of possibilities to add in. But I feel like because it's so big, sometimes I'll go through really long stretches where there's no movement cards. Or I'll be looking for a specific element and it's just not coming out. And that can kind of bother me a little bit.
But you can always buy the stock cards.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not as good movement cards, but you do have that as an option.
This reminds me of something we mentioned when talking about Dominion, the idea of having multiple currencies in a deck building game and requiring the need for multiple, like, for the different types, and how you can get into situations where you're just like, I really need money this turn, or the equivalent of money, and you draw a whole hand of movement cards. I know the game has a lot of cards that can do both. But you get into those situations where you're like, oh, I have enough boots right now to literally run across the board, but I don't need to move.
I think a lot of games that do use cards as a central mechanic, deck builders, but also ones where cards are a primary action tool, they run into an issue where after a certain number of expansions, they build up a really big pile, and you do get into that where you need to curate the deck. What's sort of weird to me about that here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it all comes in the box this way. Like, it's not like it got bloated over time. This game is only a couple of years old, and it was intended to be played this way. So I sort of assume that just that really streaky aspect of the central deck and the central market is intended, but it still does feel a little bit rocky sometimes.
There is an expansion that can be added. Like, you can make the deck bigger, but there's an expansion that adds a different deck, but you're not wrong. Speaking to Matt's point really quickly, though, I want to circle back to this when we talk about Eldorado, because Eldorado solves that problem that Matt came up with in a really unique way, that every card has an intrinsic value even when it's not printed on there. So, but yeah, I'm right there with you, Matt. And one of the things when I teach this game that I always remind people of, because it never fails towards the end of the game, is that you need to constantly be aware of, if we're talking in currencies, your movement currency. Because towards the end of the game, you're going to need to move. And if you've been buying all these cool cards or cards that are worth value points, you're going to get stuck at a really frustrating point. So I'm always like, every other turn, find some boots. Somehow get a footstep, get some way to advance, because your deck is going to get out of whack. And it's been a really good way to teach deck builders to people, because it's very obvious that they will see where they went wrong. When they run out of those movement cards in their deck, they're going to go, oh, now I want to play again, because now I understand what you were trying to tell me when you were teaching the game.
The idea of having boots at the end, it brings up an interesting strategy that I find developing in this game, that once one person has left the dungeon, I kind of then start evaluating, okay, is it reasonable that I'm going to get out of the dungeon? If no, then I start thinking, okay, how can I risk getting more points and then deliberately dying just above the villager save line, mm-hmm. and have the villagers just res me back to life? Which is interesting. It's interesting to get into that scenario where you're like, all right, I could pick up another monkey idol and then just let the dragon kill me above the resurrection line. And I like kind of playing that gamble at the end of the game. And then, but then you risk, you know, oh, the monster, like the dragon killed me on the wrong step, right. And I died below the res line. But I like kind of bouncing right up and down along that line in those last few turns and just accepting the death either way.
I really like the consistency of the artwork. I like the theme of it.
The style is strong.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Sometimes, and the art to board style coincides really nicely too. It's not like one is, they feel the same way.
Yeah, except I don't like that in a lot of board games where the cards have one style of art, the board has a different style of art, your player board has a different style of art, but this game all feels the same mm-hmm. game. I really like the components. I think they have a nice little pop. This is great because I like that this game could have been completely overproduced with like miniatures yeah. that are running around and like a miniature for the dragon and all this stuff. But it's just like meeples. It's a nice, everything yeah. works really well together.
A little touch that I really like about this game is that everyone's health track is just on the main board.
Yeah, that's nice.
They didn't try to give you some like little silly sideboard mm-hmm. to keep track of your own health with your own cube sitting on it. Like, it wasn't necessary. I like the little touch of the health just being attached to the main board. Like, it's a simplicity in its components, and I enjoy the little decisions like that.
An interesting part of this game that I wasn't expecting is the market within the game. Like, the game has its own market. Beyond the card market, there is an actual space on the board, which is a market where you can go to basically buy victory points or skills. I mean, you can get things like a Bat-Pat that lets you get two artifacts if you're brave enough to try and take some of those. That's been a point of contention for some people, in that you can race there with enough money to get something and kind of outbuy anyone else. You can kind of just hang around the market and keep money shopping to get points. But I think it's really cool that you have that option if you want to play that style of a game. Maybe grab an early artifact and then just camp out at the market, get a bunch of coins, and try and run out of there. In later expansions of the game, they actually kind of break the market up. They put it in different spots. They put the artifact, like, you can't buy everything in one spot, I think, in one of the expansions. So they play with that little internal mechanism they put in the game. And I think that secondary market elevates the game to just high enough that it gives those paths that you were speaking to earlier, Aaron, that there are different ways to progress through the dungeon and through the game, with different hubs that you kind of want to hit along the way. And I like that a lot.
Okay, so with that, I think I'm going to switch gears and move us into Quest for Eldorado. Quest for Eldorado was published in 2017 by Ravensburger Games. It was designed by Reiner Knizia, with art by Franz Wowinkel. In Quest for Eldorado, players are daring adventurers who embark on a search for the lost city of gold, Eldorado. Players are assembling teams of experts, acquiring valuable equipment, and planning their path through the jungle to be the first to reach Eldorado. This is a deck-building game, where players will be using their decks to move their meeples across the board toward Eldorado. The board in this game represents the jungle with various different types of terrain. The board is modular, and the game comes with several different layouts that can be created. The modular boards are separated by blockades, which players will be collecting throughout the game. On a player's turn, they will do three things. They start out by playing cards in their hands, and unlike most deck-building games, cards can be kept in hand between turns. Most cards can either be used for movement or for currency to buy new cards. If a card is used for movement, players will compare the terrain symbols on their card to the terrain symbols on the hexes on the board and move their pieces accordingly. At the beginning of the game, most hexes only have one symbol on each hex, but as players get closer to El Dorado, hexes will have multiple of the same symbol. Some cards will have multiple copies of the same symbol as well, and players may use a single card to move past multiple hexes, but players may not combine symbols from multiple cards to move onto a single hex. Blockades will also have certain terrain symbols on them, and players will collect the blockades by playing a card with the necessary symbols. If cards are used as currency instead of movement, each card is worth half a coin, unless stated otherwise on the card. There is a market of 6 slots for cards that are available to be purchased, and the cost of the cards are listed on the cards themselves. If there is ever an empty slot in the market when a player wants to buy a card, there is a whole pool of additional piles of cards that a player can buy one of, and then place the remainder in that open slot. Players are limited to only purchasing one card per turn, though. There are also special cards that allow players to do additional actions beyond just moving, such as gaining other cards from the market. The game ends at the end of the round where at least one player has reached El Dorado. In the event that two players reach El Dorado, ties are broken by whoever has collected the most blockades throughout the game.
I haven't played this game. I briefly looked over the rules so I'd have some idea what we were going to be talking about. And I have one major question from looking over the rules briefly. My understanding is outside of tiebreaker, there are no points and it's just a race to the finish.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Just I love that about it.
Whoever gets the last space first just wins outside of ties.
It's not quite the last space. There's not just one way to get to the last space. You could access it from multiple points. So you can both end up like stuck waiting for the right card to get into the last space on there. But yeah, that is essentially it, Matt. You want to get to El Dorado first.
Yeah, this is another game that's extremely literal as far as board games go. And it's not just a matter of you're moving across a map. It's the obstructions that you're meeting feel very natural. There's a body of water here that just can't be passed unless you have some specialists. The directness of the terrain types makes the experience feel more grounded than a lot of other games can. And I mean, I really like this designer. I really like a lot of his games, but there's nothing about the Lost Cities card game that feels like you're actually exploring. I mean, you're building stacks of cards together, you know?
Jameson's knock on Lost Cities aside.
One of my favorite games.
Yeah, whatever. You're out of the Lost Cities fan club now. Yep. Is there kind of like a pace to the game? Like, does everyone seem to generally be at the same distance to the goal at the same time? Or is there kind of like someone will fall behind and then catch up? Or does everyone kind of incrementally seem to move together outside of just bad gameplay and someone falling behind?
Sorry. Yeah, in my experience, it really depends. So there's a lot of different maps, and the variety of maps and the way that they're put together, I think, is one of the big selling points about this.
It is very modular.
They're very clever. You can just go crazy and build your own, but there's a lot of pre-made maps that feel really interesting. A lot of the tempo is driven by whether or not the player that's sort of physically in the front is working toward their own efficiency or is trying to slow other people down, or neither or both. And then depending on the map, there might be other really big natural obstacles that everybody needs to kind of get through an entire step of the deck in order to be able to overcome. So like there might be a giant river and nobody hits that river with more than a token amount of water navigation. Yeah. And they just people need to cycle new cards through their deck in order to be able to pass it or go way around it.
Right. I think that's the decision-making point there, Matt. You have options. You definitely can play a slow game. You can race. But I think the most effective way to play the game is with that future sight in mind. Like you know the end game, what the end map tile looks like and what you're going to need to get there. So you want to be building for now, but you also know that down the road, you're going to want a certain combination of cards. If there's a big village at the end and you need lots of money to get to the village, you're going to start accumulating that early on in the game. And it might slow you down initially, but you know when you hit that last tile, you're going to be the one to sprint for the finish. So there have been a number of games where it may feel like you're playing a slower game, but it's because you have a different goal in mind. Whereas someone is taking a more rambling path because on the outskirts you can often get by with lower value cards, but it's not as efficient. And you can also block players. I mean, you can sit on, sometimes there can be a really easy pass through the mountains or some way, and you could sit upon there for a while and just not really move too efficiently if you're looking with that. That happens a lot in a two-player game because in a two-player game, you're controlling two pawns each. And you can, there's a really cool cat and mouse effect that you can sort of leave one pawn behind, race one ahead. And I actually really enjoyed the two-player version of this game.
Yeah, and one thing I left out of the summary, which is a big part of the game, is that two meeples can't be on the same space. So it really creates that blocking effect and really
can you
adds
move
to the race.
Through each other?
No.
And you can't move through your own stuff either. So it actually is. I really enjoyed the two-player variant, and I'm seriously considering buying this game because you're not just managing one expedition in two different places. You're really managing two that just have access to the same resources.
Mm-hmm.
And tying back into something you said ago, you're always looking at the end goal and about the really big problems that are going to be confronting you right toward the end, you know, on the final tile or two. One of the nice things about this game is that none of the cards are valueless. And one of you brought it up earlier. I don't remember who it was, but can you talk a little bit about how you can use all cards for currency?
Right. So unlike in some games, and I think we spoke a little bit of this in Clank, you can reach a spot where you need one thing desperately. You need machetes to get through this jungle that's in front of you, and your deck might just not be giving them to you. Instead of having a handful of cards that's a waste, you always have the option to use a card as a half coin. So if you need to buy that round and you don't have enough money to make it, you can ditch cards. But the coolest part of this game, and where I think Reiner Knizia's designmanship...
Craftsmanship,
let's go. It shows the strongest, and where I think it does relate to his other games, is the hand management aspect. Because unlike other deck builders, you don't have to play your entire hand. So you have the ability to hold on to something and go, I know this is coming down the road, I'm going to sacrifice this card now because I know there's something good in my deck that's going to combine with this card, and that's going to get me through that obstacle that I need to get through. And once I'm through that obstacle, I can play these cards and just race five spaces ahead, which is going to put me way in the lead. So that's a really cool element of this game that I haven't found in other deck builders, and I like that.
One thing I really like about this game that you mentioned earlier about how you need the coin cards to get through the villages, I love that they did that. I love that the currency cards serve a double purpose. Mm-hmm. So not only can every movement card be used as a very low currency card, all the currency cards can be used for movement cards in particular spots.
And the currency cards themselves are pretty thematic. Like if you look at other deck builders, I'll use Ascension as an example. Like it isn't really clear how having a Mystic gets you more dragons or whatever. Like there's it's really tenuous. Here you're hiring a millionaire and he's now along for the ride and he's going to be financing you at certain points. He might get you through this sort of metropolis that you've stumbled onto. You might be hiring a photographer. And so it really, your deck develops a character that other deck builders sort of go for, but this, it just translates better here. If it's not clear, this is one of the board games that I am most excited about playing again, period. I would say it's one of the five board games that I'm most excited to play again.
Included in the game, too, is, as Ravensburger often does, there's a little mini expansion. There's a variable, which I play with every time. Did you play with it in your...
Which one was that? I don't think I did.
The caves?
No, so I didn't use the caves.
There are mountain tiles on the board, and you have the option to stack those mountain tiles with basically tokens, and they act like wild cards. So you can sacrifice a turn and go pause next to a mountain. You can't just sit and part there. You would have to move away and go back to collect more tokens, but you can collect a random thing, which is a one-shot, okay, here's three machetes that I can spend at any time during the game. But I had to sacrifice a turn because those caves are like way in the corners of tiles. So they're often really worth it because they're that one thing that you need during a turn that lets you jump 10 tiles ahead maybe, or 10 hexes ahead, but you don't really know if it's worth it. It's sort of a wild card. And I love that aspect of the game because you can totally ignore it if you want to, but it adds just another choice and option for you, especially when the map gets really tight.
Yeah, it can be a blue shell mechanic. If somebody's edging you out or if you're just kind of behind, it can be what you need to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I included the caves from the very first time I played on. I think it adds a lot to the game, and I don't think it adds very much complexity whatsoever.
No, not because you can ignore it. You can play a straight deck builder. The other thing I really enjoy about this game is the way the market works. So as Aaron mentioned in the summary, you have six standard cards that the game is always going to start with, and they're your, what I would say are your basic, everyone gets this basic starting deck, but from that starting deck, you can expand in one of those six ways, and they're very common. But once one of those piles is used up, and there's only three cards in each of those piles, so yeah, you have a very limited opportunity, let's say, to acquire that card type, because as soon as it's gone, it's out of play. You're not going to see it again. And you don't know what it's going to be replaced with. There's no guarantee that the sea captain is going to be replaced with something that gives you ocean movement or water movement abilities. You might not see those again till late stage in the game. So have a plan for what's going to come out. But as soon as something new comes out, you have to evaluate, ooh, is that worth it to me? Do I want that? I mean, Aaron took one of those cards. If he has one, maybe I need to have one in my deck too. Like, I don't want to be at a disadvantage down the road. And that ability to choose from anything in the market and then have that selection become the next available market to everyone else is really, really interesting.
And that is a real limitation, not just because there's a limited number, but also the cards aren't being replaced by luck. The person who buys the last one, or the person who has the first opportunity to enter a new stack?
First opportunity to enter a new stack.
So there's a real sort of cat and mouse game with, if you want to hand your opponent the opportunity to change the market, or if you yourself want to just sort of back off a little while.
It's really interesting to me hearing you guys talk so positively about this game, because me just kind of looking at the rules and looking at what is the Ravensburger art style, I don't think I would ever be drawn to this game. I think if I saw it on the shelf, I would just kind of look at it and be like, that's okay. That looks a little simple. It looks a little meh. And I would probably walk by it. So it's really interesting to hear you guys actually raving about it, basically, when just from appearances, I probably wouldn't have given it a second thought.
I would not have played this game if it weren't for the podcast. I just wouldn't have. And when I saw it, I kind of assumed it was like from the late 90s or something, because the art style is so restrained. But I really do like it a lot.
The only reason I picked this game up in the first place was because I love the designer, and people have been raving about this game as just a great game. And people have been saying, oh, it's a gateway game, it's really a starter game. And people that actually played multiple times are saying, no, there's more game there than you're giving it credit for. And I find that's often the case in Reiner Knizia's games, and so I wanted to see if it was true. It was also the Amazon deal of the day, and it was $15.
Wow.
So I was shipped, like, literally, there is no harm in getting this thing. I think I had, like, points to pay for it, so it is well worth its weight in things.
See, that's really interesting to me, Josh, and this is going to take us into comparison, because I thought, because doing my own research, looking into these games, I've seen a lot of people on the Clank forums talk about, if you're going to play two players, don't get Clank, get Quest for El Dorado instead. So I assume that was why you got it. It's just because it was a better two-player version of Clank.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly true too, Aaron. I can see that. I think the two-player version of El Dorado is more strategic. I actually think I would probably like it more than the four-player version, just because you have so much more control in it. And Clank with two is okay. I don't think it's the way Clank is meant to be played, though. It gets too... two cat and mouse, one person takes that artifact, and then you know that they're going to go, and then it's just a race. And which is ironic, because in the game like Quest for El Dorado, which is a race game, feels more strategic. It feels more like you have control over two meeples, and you have to manage a few more resources between two different expeditions, and I like that about it a lot. But yeah, I think both games are excellent. Like I said, I didn't know if there was room in my collection for both games. I was like, oh, I have a deck builder that has a board already, but the race aspect of it is what felt different to me. And I know Reiner Knizia's style. I really enjoy the mechanisms and the thought and the analysis that goes into his games and the way that his gameplay rewards repeated play. And so I wanted that aspect, where I think Clank is a bit more random. El Dorado feels more controlled. It feels more thoughtful and more straightforward.
Hearing you compare them, Josh, actually, it makes me think I would enjoy El Dorado more in that two-player format.
You would. I would,
because yep. I, you know, Reiner Knizia has a thing for two-player games. Like, he knows how to do it, and I really enjoy that. And I have to say, I'm not the biggest Clank fan. Like, I think it's fun, but I was never tempted to go out and buy it because I don't think I would ever, on my own, be like, oh, let's play Clank. I don't know what it is about it. Maybe because it is less strategic, that, you know, it is kind of that race for the points and then get out, which in the moment I really enjoy. Like, I love the tension in the game, and if you put it in front of me, it's an enjoyable play experience. But I think, like, outside the game, my brain never screams, let's play Clank right now. While the way you describe El Dorado, I think I would totally sit there and be like, it'd be one of those games where I'd be like, hey, Josh, yep. let's play some two-player El Dorado and go at it.
Yeah, Matt, I feel exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. While I'm playing Clank, I have a great time, but I'm not looking forward to Clank in any real way. It's not a game I would recommend. It's not a game that I would pick out at a board game night. I would absolutely recommend it, but it doesn't feel, for me, it just doesn't have the same draw.
I would posit that that's because I think we figured it out. I think we know what you need to do to be successful in Clank. There isn't a...
Some of us do.
All right, Aaron aside, the rest of us have a good strategy for how to successfully play Clank. I would encourage you to try the expansion sometime because it adds a few twists on the game that change it up a bit. But especially for you, Matt, I think once you've figured a game out or have a good strategy of how it should be played best, your interest level wanes. Because I do think there's more efficient ways to play Clank than others. It's still fun, though. I agree with all of you that Clank is a fun game experience, and I would never say no to it. El Dorado has a more simplistic play style, but that lends a bit more depth to the play, and I think it lends itself to repeated plays more easily.
El Dorado is more competitive, too.
Yeah.
I think that's Reiner Knizia. Sorry, Jameson.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fine.
Like, that's how he designs his games. Like, they're... Usually, especially the two-player kind of card games, they're deceptively simple and really cutthroat underneath.
We owe him an episode sometime soon.
Could just combine a couple of the episodes we've already
done. Yeah, it's true.
But one thing about it, though, like Clank has this beautiful board, and part of what makes Clank fun and replayable is you're returning to the same dungeon again and again. Quest for El Dorado, even playing the same map can be different. Like, and it's open for customization. Even taking the same set of six tiles in the same order, you can set them up in sufficiently different ways that you can have a different experience. Just that raw number of combinations means that there's just going to be more depth to Quest for El Dorado. Mm-hmm. At the same time, and this is something I appreciate about both games, the games themselves are really conservative. These are not Fantasy Flight situations where you have a big board and then sideboards and then a two dozen cards. Like, everything is really restrained. And even the market in El Dorado, which seems like it on paper like it might be a mess, it's just 18 little stacks. At the end of the day, you just put the same cards together. Mm-hmm. You put them in whatever order you want. It's really easy to set up and tear down. There's not a lot of junk.
So these are both games that I own and has sought out and caught my attention. And I think they speak to the title of this episode in a certain way that we call this episode Deck Builders Plus. And for me, these games add more to a mechanic which is somewhat dry and somewhat overused in a lot of ways. They bring a freshness, they bring a purpose, and the board focus to the deck builders gives me a level of control and a level of, as Jameson said earlier, reality. Like, there is something very actual about your quest to build a deck and to achieve a goal in this game. And I really like the way the board and the game design facilitates that and brings it beyond just a mere deck builder while still using that core element.
I think if you listened to the episode where we talked about Dominion, none of us were, I don't know, say particularly over the moon talking about Dominion. And a lot of that was about the basic deck building nature of it. I think if you compare our opinions then to what we've said today about our enjoyment in Clank and El Dorado, I think that speaks to the plus aspect of these games and how much that plus gives an infusion to the deck building.
So what are some other games that you would recommend that just add a little extra to deck building?
Yeah, what are some other games that do bring a new spin to what could otherwise be a pretty tired mechanic?
I'll go first, I guess. I am going to put on a game that adds a lot to deck building, which is...
Which is an entire game,
but we've talked about this game before in an episode, so if you want to learn more, check in there. But it is Great Western Trail by another of my favorite designers, Alexander Pfister. In Great Western Trail, the deck building element is, it's not a subset of the game, but it serves the gameplay in a more direct way. You're progressing around a board multiple times, and the way that you build your deck is sort of what you're working to achieve by the time you reach your goal each time. And that successful deck building can make or break you in the game. It's a big component of the game, or it can be a component that you can almost completely ignore in some ways. So it's a great use of the deck building mechanic, I think. So that's Great Western Trail.
My recommendation is Blood Bowl Team Manager, the card game. This is, I believe, is out of print, but it was heavily produced by Fantasy Flight Games, so it's not hard to get a copy of it now. It's set in the old Warhammer Fantasy universe and the defunct Warhammer Fantasy universe. It's a game about football, and there are these different teams that have very distinct play styles, so distinct, in fact, that you can really, there is a lot of room for repeated play here. But the whole experience is just you are putting on headlines. You are headlining the individual plays in a season to try to make your team get the best possible bowl spot and get the most fame. And through that, you know, you're cheating, you're hiring people, you're firing people, you've got injuries, you've got intrigue, it's a great time.
I recommend Pathfinder, the adventure card game. It's not only a deck builder, but it's a very slow deck builder because each scenario you're adventuring, and you only really add one or two cards into your deck each time you play, but it's a legacy game. It's like a 30-scenario legacy game that you adventure through, and you slowly, over, you know, months of sessions of playing, curate the perfect deck of only 25 to 30 cards. It's a really small deck that you have to stay to do some crazy awesome things with. This game doesn't get a lot of love, gets a lot of anti-love, but I'm totally for it, and I think everyone should go out, and I think you can only get it on Amazon now. Barnes & Noble doesn't carry it anymore, but go out and buy it.
Matt, is it legacy or is it campaign? Are you destroying cards?
No, I guess it's a campaign.
Okay, I guess it... I was getting more interested in thinking if it was legacy.
Yeah, I was also like, maybe get this thing going.
Well, I guess it's legacy. I guess it is a campaign. I guess in my head, it counted as legacy because you change your characters as you go, and you unlock box content as you progress.
Okay, that does sound legacy to me.
Which once you know what's coming, it's kind of makes the scenarios a lot easier to play. So I guess that's what made it legacy to me, was that it kept adding content, and you do remove content as the game goes on, but you don't destroy content just so you can reset the box and give it to somebody else. But content does get removed. So
interesting.
I would err that it's probably closer to the campaign, but it kind of straddles it in my head.
And my recommendation, which I have definitely talked about a lot in the past, or at least once in the past, is Marvel Legendary. It's a deck building game where you are building your decks in order to go fight villains. I love Marvel Comics. I'm recommending it again because it's fun. Check it out. Although I did see that they are re-releasing the base set using the Marvel Cinematic Universe stills, and I'm not happy about that. I like the comic art. I don't like Spider-Man.
You hate that Spider-Man version.
Hate that Spider-Man expansion.
You've definitely mentioned that before.
Definitely don't like this new thing either.
So Pathfinder in particular has a lot of cards to manage, and I think it's worth having a conversation about it because we do come at it from different angles. I know Aaron, for one, almost never sleeves anything, whereas until I started playing with these guys, my instinct was, if it's a card, it probably needs to be sleeved.
I never sleeve anything either.
I don't anymore, but that's because you guys really rubbed off on me.
Wait, you used to sleeve everything?
Oh, everything. But I didn't have that many games, though, so it was less of an issue. But yeah, I would, like, because the games that I play, and maybe this speaks to a certain part of our audience too. The games that I own are usually games that I'll play again and again and again. Lost Cities is an example of one. I mean, if they're kind of oversized, so they're not sleeved, but that would be an example of something that might have actually been smart for me to sleeve early on because of how frequently I play with it. It is really common for cards that I play with a lot to develop some deformities. Normally they aren't so distinctive that they can be identified by the backs, and normally it isn't like so cracked that you can't tell from the artwork what it is. But there is a lot more wear and tear on my collection because my collection is so much smaller than all your guys.
On the topic of sleeving, I have only sleeved the Pathfinder card game and only the cards that were in our personal decks. That because you curated the cards for so long, certain cards would stick with you for so many plays. Like Jameson mentioned, like the more you play a game, the more use it gets. I would have everyone sleeve their own deck, and then when you got a new card, you would sleeve it. But the rest of the cards, just because once they're out there, they don't really see the light of day much. There was also like 2,000 cards or something with the game, so it would be ridiculous to sleeve it all by the end. But to sleeve three people's deck of 25, that was helpful. Especially because... Oh, sorry, Jameson, go ahead.
I love that. And I'm guessing each player had a completely separate set of sleeves? Or using transparent ones?
I was using transparent
ones. Oh, okay. So I actually, I used to play a lot of customizable card games, and I loved just the personality of, especially like a draft or something, you know, the moment where you have your pile of cards and you just exclude a bunch and you put your sleeves on them, and that is what you're going to use for the night. And I, you know, I have Twilight Imperium sleeves, actually. Of course I do.
If I ever played it again, or a different set of it, I would probably totally do that, especially because when we played, we each had our own dice, and our dice became a personality of the character we played. Because you're basically role playing who you are, and you would curate your deck that way. Anyway, I would do the sleeves that way too, to make them match, because it would just add more investment into this really long game campaign. But also, it helped sleeves. We always like ate and drank when we were playing, so you would get stuff. Occasionally, like, someone had like one thing on their finger and they would touch the card and you'd be like, oh, thank God, there's a sleeve on this card.
Yeah, if there's ever pizza grease or just like pools of condensation from ice water around on your table, and there's always is on mine, it's really nice to have some sleeves.
I hate the way you have to shuffle with sleeves.
I do too, Aaron.
I'm
right there with you.
You can't rifle shuffle. It's just like moving them around. It's like almost like that swirling the cards around.
I don't like
it
at all. I don't like the feel of the plastic. I mean, I don't like plastic in general, and like that just is so, it seems silly to me. I don't have the time that I want to put cards in the sleeve for how many games that I have, and it's just not me. I don't think I've worn out any games. I've worn out a copy of Lost Cities, and by worn out, I mean the cards have some wear on them. I still play with them, but I also don't look that carefully at cards to notice things. I won't notice a slight deformity in the cards. By the time it's shuffled and it's in someone's hand, I'm not going to look at it. Like, I just wouldn't notice it. A couple of our friends like can't help but see it. Like, they will see anything, different things. I'm not one of those people, so I've never seen the need.
Yeah, like, I kind of look at my dented like Lost Cities and Quiddler as like, it's a little badge of honor. Like,
me
I
too.
Play like Lost Cities is so much fun that I play it so much that the cards have a little wear and tear. Now, if the cards were like ripped in little places, yes, or like had giant fold creases down the middle, that would be a different thing. But to have little nicks on the corners and just a tad bit of like sun damage, especially like things like Lost Cities, like that you would play outside on the porch, like it's part of the character of the game. It also helps that those games cost like $10. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't kind of ruin your life in that way. That being said, I wouldn't take my copy of like Sentinels outside, because even though I'm kind of fine with rifle shuffling those cards, because you really only shuffle the deck like once per game, it's not really that often that you reshuffle your whole deck, I wouldn't take it outside because it's an expensive game and I wouldn't want to sun damage the cards. Yeah, I think it all depends on game.
If we're getting into outside with games, that's a whole different conversation, because I have major feelings about that. Something that I don't get in the community is that the number of people that sleeve their cards, because I could definitely understand sleeving cards if I only have five games and I really like these games and I'm playing these games all the time.
Or you're a heavy Magic the Gathering player.
Yeah.
Not, like, your deck is your thing. Like, that's different.
And you keep going back, but there's so many people in the community that they're not playing the games that many times.
Right.
And so I'll see people that'll be on forums and be like, well, is this storage solution going to fit my sleeve cards? And I'm like, is that necessary? Like, are you really going to be playing that game so much that it really needs to be sleeved?
I don't understand it at all.
And yeah. No offense, like, if that is your thing, like, I totally get it. I'd actually kind of just like to understand it a little bit more.
There are a lot of real downsides. I mean, there's the expense, there's the time you spend putting them all in, but they take up more space. It basically doubles, or sometimes, depending on how crappy the cardstock is, triples the thickness of the cards. It increases all of their other dimensions, too.
It hurts the environment, too.
It does. It kills that environment. I don't really understand the logic of it either. For me, like I said, I have a very small handful of games, and honestly, The one that is the most over the top in terms of sleeve volume is also the ones that has the flimsiest cards. So it really is like a skeleton for it. It's a structural thing. I'm probably going to, like, I haven't played that game in years. I'm probably, now that I remember I owned it, thanks to this conversation, I'm probably going to go back in and take all the sleeves out because I can use them for something else.
I do think there are a few games that that have poor card quality. I think most games have a pretty good standard of card quality. I just think Clank is one of the games that has pretty low card quality. I think they're thin and they could get damaged relatively easily now that I think about it. But again, even with that, mine are still fine. Mm-hmm. I've played it 10, 20, I don't know how many times. So I don't know. It's one of those, it's an additional expense thing, it's an additional time thing, and I don't see the value in it for me personally.
The one exception, the things that I actually do sleeve, are social deduction games or hidden roll games, where it's just that hidden roll card, just because, especially for games like Crossfire that get passed around the board or passed around the table. And I know we've had parts of this sleeving conversation before, and I've mentioned that before, mm-hmm. but those are the things that I actually will sleeve.
Those make sense.
Going on, though, to shuffling of cards and of rifle shuffling versus non-rifle shuffling, where does everyone fall into these camps?
I'm like 95-5, probably. Like, rifle shuffling is perfectly A-OK 95% of the time. I think it's very rare that I'll come across something that I'm like, God, please don't rifle shuffle that. In this moment right now, I don't think I could give you an example of when I would not rifle shuffle something. Something will probably pop into my head as we're talking right now, but yeah, nothing at the top of my head right now.
I like it. I just gentle rifle shuffle.
Yeah.
Like, because you don't need to bend the cards.
There's the two different ways. There's the rifle shuffling and the rifle shuffling where you break the cards.
Right.
And like, you don't need to bend them at that angle that breaks them.
Now, if I saw someone doing that, I'd be like, I'll just shuffle. Yeah, I'll actually handle this. You don't need to do this. Like, yeah. Actually, this is expensive. I'm just going to take care of it. And if that offends them, that's fine. Because people on the forums do have a fear of like offending people about the way... Like, people must really walk on eggshells over other people playing their games because they don't want them to not play with them. But at the same time, if you're really concerned about it, just be like, I'm going to shuffle the game. Like, no offense to anyone else. I'll just do the shuffling, just pass it to me and be done with it. That would be an easy solution. Same thing. Everyone talks about greasy fingers. Why aren't people giving people napkins? Just get a paper towel right there.
What about
there,
the environment, Josh? Come on.
Paper towels are just compostable. I don't know. I just feel like having a paper towel pretty much solves all those problems, in my opinion. But... whatever. I'm just old-fashioned like that, I guess.
I guess I have greasy friends. Not you guys. They don't listen to this.
I don't know why that tickled me
so much. Oh, you know what? Okay, people might want to see their games, because there's another thing people do a lot. A lot of people talk about cats walking on their tables with board games all the time. Like, that's a really common thing that people talk about in the forums, is that, like, they leave games set up or game boxes that cats just crawl into. Like, I guess if you were sitting with the game boss on the floor and the cat was just, like, sitting in your cards, maybe then sleeves would be really useful, but...
This is such a tangent, but when we were playing a game at Jameson's the other night, his cat, like, walked into the cat.
See?
Into the
That's box. A thing. That's a real thing. Cats apparently love board game boxes.
But I don't think sleeves would help. As a cat owner, I think the sleeves would actually make them more interesting to the cats.
All right.
And probably more likely to get damaged.
No. See? That.
But, like I said, I mean, even with shuffling, too, a lot of it... I am not married to one kind, but it's going to have to be... There's no one-size-fits-all solution, at least not for me. If I'm only shuffling 10 cards, that's going to be very different than if I have to shuffle a deck of 200. Do any of you guys ever use a mechanical shuffler? Like,
when I played Canasta with my grandma.
Yeah,
like when we were playing with huge stacks of cards doing card games with my mom and dad, like Contract Army with my mom and dad, there was a time when if you're doing like three full decks of 52 each, sometimes it's easier, but it just doesn't seem like there's a good solution there. One other big aspect of card maintenance, so I talked a lot about just having a couple of games that we're playing fairly frequently. If you have games with a lot of cards in them that are sitting on the shelf, if you have collections, what are ways that you organize those cards or keep them from falling all over the place?
Or store the boxes, yeah.
How does storage work, Aaron?
Horizontal box storage.
Yep.
Make sure the box is stored horizontally and not vertically if it has a bunch of cards in it.
I'm with you there too, Matt. I know people swear by vertical storage, but I'm mostly horizontal for anything that has pieces that are going to fall out, because I just hate opening up a box of a game and going, oh man, I got to separate all these things, and it drives me crazy.
It's sort of weird to me, though, because like, you guys will still break up individual components. Like, is there something that feels wrong about just sticking a deck of cards in a Ziploc bag?
I always put all my cards go into Ziploc bags. Yeah. And there's people that are really big on tuck boxes, like getting just card boxes and using those.
I've never done this, but people they sell like crazy all the time, and I'm always like, oh, this would be interesting, I guess.
Yeah, every board game I have has the decks of cards in a plastic bag, unless there's a decent storage solution that holds them. And then with games like Dominion or Legendary, I store all my games horizontally, but if I was ever tempted to go vertical, you just can't do it those games, because it's all going to fall out.
You'd have to insanely baggy it first before putting, and even then, all the baggies are just going to fall to one end of the box.
What about a game like the Cards in Arcadia Quest, Aaron? Like, that game has a bunch of cards, and they're all split into different levels. Those are just all bagged.
All in little bags?
Yeah, for mine, too. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think it's a great idea, and I'm 100% on board with it. Is that something that the community as a whole has adopted, or are there people out there who swear by just gently putting them in a line?
No. It's all bags or tuck boxes.
Our friend, and he'll know exactly who he is if he ever listens to this episode, just throws every component for the entire game into a box. Everything. Every card is loose. Every component is loose. He just takes his arm, sweeps up every piece off the table, and it just all goes into a box together. And it is hell on earth. It is hell to watch, and it is hell to have to set up the game the next time, because the box is just thousands of components and cards just all mixed up together.
Ease of future play is a major concern. I don't want anything that's going to be hard to set up. Like, I look for the easiest, get the game to the table to play storage solution possible is my MO.
Yeah, I really hate the time that goes into setting up games. And what makes me especially curious about that is, I mean, it would seem to me as a non-colorblind person that sorting decks from a giant heap would be easier, would be more difficult. Because I think color is such an important part of organizing, I mean, decks and anything, really, but decks and player pieces are the big ones. And when you have huge piles of cards, giving them really distinct backs, I think that's part of what appeals to people about sleeving, too. It's one of those things. Like, some games just don't, they have multiple decks, and those decks are not visually distinct enough for it to be easy to set up.
Okay, I think that's about enough for our card maintenance conversation. I think we got a lot of, interesting things thrown out there.
But point to the masses, whatever you do, that's fine. If you want to sleeve those cards, it's totally fine. No judgment from Men on Board.
It is your game. Yeah. You your store game. Your game. You protect your game at whatever level of protection you want for your game.
Yeah, your planet Earth.
No, our planet. Wrong idea.
Join us in 2 weeks, where our category is going to be app integration. We're going to talk about Stop Thief and Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. Our music was generously provided to us by the Pittsburgh-based band Delicious Pastries. If you'd like to email us, you can reach us at menonboardpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at menonboardpodcast. Find us on Twitter at menonboardpod. We have a guild over on BoardGameGeek. Our website is menonboardpodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye, everyone. I'd like to say that my aunt gives us constructive criticism all the time.
Yeah.
And I just ignore it because she doesn't listen to the show, and she just wants us to change our name and logo and everything about us every time to make us more like super fantabulous fabulous. She doesn't like anything we do. But she doesn't listen to us. She doesn't listen to us.
That's reassuring. That's good.